It is in our hands to leave these dark machines behind, the dark ages where they belong, and to press forward to cap a historic movement towards a new world order and a long era of peace.
The President George Bush has talked time and time again about a new world order, and this is the best chance to begin to establish the new world order.
In 1989, President Bush said, and it's a phrase that I often use myself, that we needed a new world order.
It's a need for a new world order, but it has different characteristics in different parts of the world.
It is a new world order with significantly different and radically new challenges for the
But in another universe, much closer to home, scientists have discovered a wealth of information within the nucleus of the living cell.
DNA has a structure that is ideal for carrying information in the A's, T's, C's, and G's. The basis of the double helix of DNA is the potential for storing a tremendous amount of information.
There is, in fact, no entity in the known universe that stores and processes more information more efficiently than the DNA molecule. A full complement of human DNA has 3 billion individual characters. Analysis of the DNA molecule's coding regions show that its chemical characters have a specific arrangement that allows them to convey detailed instructions or information, much like letters in a meaningful sentence or binary digits in a computer code.
Bill Gates has said that DNA is like a computer program, only much more complex than any we've been able to devise. And if you reflect on that even for a minute, it's a highly suggestive observation, because we know that Bill Gates does not employ wind and erosion or random number generators to generate his software. Instead, he employs intelligent engineers, software engineers. And so everything we know in our experience suggests that information-rich systems arise from intelligent design. But what do we make of the fact that there is information in life, in every living cell of every living organism? That's the fundamental mystery. Where does that information come from?
For the past 15 years, philosopher and scientist Stephen Meyer has worked to answer this question. Meyer has developed an argument to demonstrate that intelligent design provides the best explanation for the origin of information necessary to build the first living cell.
It's part of our knowledge base that intelligent agents can produce information-rich systems. So the argument is not based on what we don't know, but it's based on what we do know about the cause and effect structure of the world. We know at present there is no naturalistic explanation, no natural cause that produces information. Not natural selection, not self-organizational processes, not pure chance. But we do know of a cause which is capable of producing information, and that is intelligence. So when people infer design from the presence of information in DNA, they're effectively making what's called in the historical sciences an inference to the best explanation. So when we find an information-rich system in the cell, in the DNA molecule specifically, we can infer that an intelligence played a role in the origin of that system, even if we weren't there to observe the system coming into existence.
Meyer's work on the origin of genetic information is now part of a comprehensive scientific case for design that grew out of a meeting of scientists and philosophers on the central coast of California in 1993. Their objective was to reassess an idea that had dominated biology for more than a century. In the process, they gave birth to a theory that has become known as intelligent design.
To me, the great promise of design is it gives us a new tool in explanation that belongs in the toolkit of science. Intelligent causes are real. They leave evidence of their existence. And a healthy science is a science that seeks the truth and lets the evidence speak for itself.
The argument for intelligent design is based on observation of the facts. Now, that's my definition of good science. It's observation of the facts. Now, when you observe the facts, as Michael Behe has done, what do you observe? you observe this incredible pattern of interrelated complexity.
And the way we conclude intelligent design for the bacterial flagellum is the same way we conclude intelligent design for an outboard motor. When we see an outboard motor, we see the way the parts interact and so on. We know somebody made that. The reasoning is the same for biological machines. So the idea of intelligent design is a completely scientific one. Certainly it might have religious implications, but it does not depend on religious premises.
When I look at the evidence objectively, without ruling out the possibility of design, design just leaps up as the most likely explanation. And that's why I believe that it's true.
I think design is back on the table. You know, we can't explain these systems by natural law. And if we're searching for truth, and they are in fact designed, if we have to be design engineers to understand them, then I say, what's the problem? You know, you go where the data leads you. And the implications, yeah, they have profound metaphysical implications, but so be it.
So it's a powerful idea that the universe is rational and comprehensible, underwritten by a supreme intelligence that meant for this world to be understood as something that underwrites then the program of science, because then you can go out and look at the world and the world will make sense. If it's all just a chaotic assemblage, there's no reason to expect any rationality out there. But if it in fact is the product of a mind, then you can go out and science becomes this enormous, wonderful puzzle-solving project in which you can expect to find rationality and beauty and comprehensibility right at the foundation of things.
For centuries, the fact that we can discover things about the universe has really been something of a mystery. Why would beings like ourselves be able to discover a universe like this? Why is what we think about the universe, why would it correspond to the way things really are?
Our ability to discern and understand the universe is a fundamental part of what makes the universe tick, so that we're linked into it. This isn't just a sort of an accident, a trivial little byproduct. It is something that is linked to the great cosmic scheme of things. Now, I have no idea how that linkage works, why it's there, or anything of that sort, but I'm very, very struck by the fact that we can understand the universe in such exquisite detail and at such a deep level.
The spectacular progress of modern astronomy and physics is the product of a universe accessible to the human eye and mind. It is a universe governed by laws and forces that literally hold our planet Earth and the entire cosmos together and are finely calibrated to allow for both complex life and scientific discovery.
If you didn't have something like gravity that pulled matter together, you would never get planets, you wouldn't get stars, you wouldn't get any complex organisms. If you didn't have the strong nuclear force, there would be nothing to hold protons and neutrons together in the nucleus. And so you wouldn't have any atoms, so no chemistry. If you didn't have the electromagnetic force, you would have no bonding between chemicals. You'd have no light. And the list goes on. You need all these sorts of fundamental principles have to be in place in order for life to occur. Wipe out one of those principles, wipe out one of those laws, no life.
During the past 40 years, scientists have determined the relative strengths of each of these primary laws and forces. These strengths are so critically balanced, they are often described as being finely tuned.
If you're to take the basic fundamental constants of nature and you were to change these even slightly, or you were to pick their values at random, you would almost never get a universe that would be habitable in any sort of way. That is, you couldn't have galaxies, you couldn't have planets, you couldn't have complex biological organisms if these fundamental constants were even slightly different, slightly stronger, slightly weaker than they actually are in this universe. That's the idea of fine-tuning.
To better appreciate this concept, imagine a machine able to control the strength of each of the physical constants. If you changed, even slightly, from its current setting, the strength of any one of these fundamental forces, such as gravity, the impact on complex life would be catastrophic.
If you increased it by a little bit, no large-scale life forms could exist. anything that was more than the size of a pea would be completely crushed. So you might be able to get life of a very, very primitive sort, such as bacteria, but you could never get conscious observers.
This is one of a long list of properties in underlying physics that seem to be prerequisites for a universe with life. For example, the strengths of the other forces are all important, the masses of the various subatomic particles. If all of these things were even a little bit different, then life, certainly life as we know it, could not exist.
If you look at the details of biochemistry and molecular biology, you might find a signature of some sort of designer.
Wait a second. Richard Dawkins thought intelligent design might be a legitimate pursuit?
And that designer could well be a higher intelligence from elsewhere in the universe.
But you're crazy to say it's God.
Heavy. Yeah. Yes, you can say it's anything you want, men from outer space, Martians, anything you want, but not God. It cannot be God.
Right.
Not allowed to be God.
Right.
Did life begin? And why should we close our eyes to the possibility that God did it, that there's an intelligent creator, and his name is G-O-D?
Yes. It amazed me to see the arrogance and, honestly, the misery that these people live in.
I think they live in a little teeny box. They're surrounded by a little teeny box of protecting themselves and their theory. They cannot look outside that box for the giant spacelessness of time and the giant spacelessness of God.
Right.
And that makes them feel bad. For them. They're famous in their circles, but they don't have God in their lives, and that makes me sad for them.
Yes. They are so closed-minded.
Yes.
I got the feeling from the movie that it's really not about science.
No, it's about them.
It's anti-God. They cannot allow God to be a part of anything.
Right, because if there is a God, then they might be judged. If there's a God who holds you accountable for your actions, you're in a lot of trouble. Now, I'm going to be the first to be, I'm in a lot of trouble too. But there's a lot, but they cannot admit that there's a possibility of sin or a possibility of morality. And they can't agree on this basic thing. If man is just a speck of dust struck by lightning and then turned into a human being, then he has no moral responsibility. If we're all children of God, we have some moral responsibility because we all have some little piece of God in us.
Yes.
That scares them to death.
Okay.
Oakland is a former evolutionist and biology instructor and is co-author of the book The Evolution Conspiracy, A Quantum Leap into the New Age.
When the communists took over Yunnan province of China, the entire population was forced to attend propaganda classes. First lesson was not some words of wisdom from Lenin or Stalin, but a fundamental course in Darwinian evolution.
One of my former graduate students turned to communism. He was brought to Moscow for training. What do you think they taught him? Lenin? Marx? No. For 2 years, they taught him in a library and taught him nothing but evolution, identifying it as the foundation of communism.
Without evolutionism, there can be no Marxism, no Leninism, no secular humanism, unless the universe created itself, unless man is God, unless there is no creator, none of these philosophies will stand.
Well, in spite of Darwin's best efforts, the implications were there for anybody to draw, and that is, he's not just talking about birds and bees and flowers. He's talking about us. He's talking about our minds. He's talking about our conscience, our soul. Everything, if Darwin is right, is made up of little ratchets doing their little ratchety thing. And it's all just mechanical and blind and purposeless at the bottom. And this was the great inversion, because until then, the idea that there was something like a life force, élan vital, or that there was something like a soul that was completely distinct from matter, and that it somehow informed and controlled and guided creative processes, thinking processes, moral reasoning, and so on. This top-down idea about morality and self and soul was very plausible until Darwin. And after Darwin, people could see that maybe the soul could be replaced with some of those ratchets. And that's a very threatening idea.
So if Darwin had not produced this dangerous idea, do you think that the development of infidelity, atheism, or disbelief, or however one wants to call it, would have been delayed?
I suppose that's a historical question that one should do very careful research on, and I haven't. But it seems very plausible to me that it was Darwin that broke the dam. Because before Darwin, there really wasn't a good answer to the question, how did this come to be? How did this bird with this wonderful wing, how did it come into existence? If not by some divine act of creation. The rhetorical question, what else could it be, had no answer.
Because you guys can't tell me how it all got here. You guys don't.
We're working on it. Physicists are,
when you get it, then maybe.
Well, no, I mean, if you look at the history of science over the centuries,
yeah,
the amount that's gained in knowledge each century is stupendous. In the beginning of the 21st century, we don't know everything. We have to be humble. We have to, in humility, say that there's a lot that we still don't know.
And, you know, being humble is a Christian virtue.
Well,
there you go.
Of course it is.
All right, when you guys figure it out, then you come back here and tell me, because until that time, I'm sticking with Judeo-Christian philosophy and my religion of Roman Catholicism.
But if your aim is to kill religion, as mine is, yeah, then just let me finish. If your aim is to kill religion, then since evolution is manifestly true, then if there are people out there who really believe that if you are an evolutionist, you've got to be an atheist, then all I've got to do is to persuade them of evolution, which should be comparatively easy, since the evidence is overwhelming, and I'll turn them all into atheists.
Your purpose is to destroy religion. Is that really your purpose?
No.
I don't think it really is.
It was an interesting piece of contrarian reasoning to what you were saying, because you were saying you don't have to be an atheist to believe in evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, is exactly. Then I tell people to go and read Ken Miller,
yeah,
Francis Collins, and indeed any reputable clergyman. But if a larger view is that the presence or absence of a God in the universe is, I mean, that's a huge question. I think it's a scientific question. I have a view on it, and I try to raise consciousness about it. Then if it's true that there are lots and lots of people who think that evolution is incompatible with religion, I actually do think it is, you see. I actually do think it is. But even if I didn't, if I were a propagandist trying to destroy religion, I would seize on that. Because
a very few people originally got control of our education system in this land. One of the things that was imperative for them to push through their programs was evolutionism.
Most people do not believe that evolution happened. The fact that most scientists do, or practically all scientists do, is in a sense neither here nor there, because in fact we would like the ideas to get across to our students.
The thing that the average Christian in America has never realized is that his tax dollars pay the school teacher's salary, they pay for the textbooks, and yet most parents still will not say one word about anything that happens in that classroom that disturbs them. For parents to allow a godless indoctrination in evolutionism is just unthinkable.
Thousands of children are bused daily to our museums as part of school-sponsored field trips, where they're given crash courses in evolution. And just like in the Soviet Union, this religion of atheism is presented as fact, with no alternate viewpoints allowed to be expressed.
Attorney Wendell Byrd argued the case for balanced treatment of creation science and evolution before the U.S. Supreme Court. He is author of the book, The Origin of Species Revisited.
To me, the basic issue is academic freedom, because no one's trying to exclude evolution from public schools while
teaching a theory of creation. Instead, the evolutionists are trying to exclude alternatives, while, in general, defending the exclusive teaching of evolution.
Well, I think creationism should be taught in schools simply because all good ideas should be taught in schools. I think we shouldn't be afraid of ideas, whether we oppose them or whether we're for them. I think we should expose everyone to both sides of the issue.
The American public believes that the theory of evolution ought to be taught along with the scientific theory of creation. According to an AP NBC News nationwide poll, lawyers nationwide, more than 2-1, agree that it is constitutional to teach the theory of creation along with the theory of evolution. And lawyers better than 2-1 believe that both should be taught in public schools.
Yes, creation should be taught in schools. Equal time should be given to evolution and creation.
42.3% of biology teachers believe in teaching a theory of creation along with the theory of evolution. And the same is true of school board members, two-thirds, according to a poll by the American School Board Journal. The fact is that contrary to all of the smoke, the great majority of the American public feels that it is unfair to teach just the theory of evolution.
No more than 6% have ever wanted only evolutionism taught, but there is such total domination and control in the scientific community that we still are placating the 6% of the people in this land who believe there is no God and believe that the universe created itself.
Should other concepts of how life got started be taught in the public schools? I don't think creationism should, because creationism is a thinly disguised religious doctrine which has got no place in the separation of church and state.
The main issue that is always raised in opposition to teaching all the scientific evidence on the subject of origins is that it violates separation of church and state to teach evidence that doesn't happen to support evolution.
People should simply be able to hear the truth. A fact is a fact. You don't throw it out just because it happens to agree with the Bible. That doesn't make it religious.
The Louisiana legislature in 1981 passed a law for, quote, balanced treatment of creation science and evolution. The law also defined what evolution is, quote, scientific evidence supporting evolution. It defined what creation science is, quote, scientific evidence supporting creation.
Immediately, aggressive litigation was put into action by a powerful organization which is firmly directed against traditional Judeo-Christian principles. The influential ACLU, or American Civil Liberties Union, equipped with over 500 active attorneys, invested huge amounts of money and successfully protested the law.
One of the biggest problems you have with the ACLU is that they're so well-funded. They get millions and millions of dollars from large foundations and from wealthy people all across America. That's what they did to us. They tied us up in court in Louisiana.
We filed a slim brief of 630 pages with 2,000 footnotes arguing that creation science is constitutional to teach, scientific in content, and as non-religious as evolution. The U.S. District Court judge entered a summary judgment against us nonetheless, saying that creation science involves the concept of creation, which implies a creator, which is inherently religious.
The ACLU was able to convince the Supreme Court that creation science was basically religious. The court violated the Constitution by redefining the First Amendment author's intention, which is against favoring any one religion above another. In their decision, the Supreme Court favored naturalistic evolution, a belief of religious humanists. Despite overwhelming scientific evidence supporting creation science, the court ruled that creationism should not be given mandatory status in public schools, but could be taught alongside evolution at the teacher's discretion. Irresponsible and slanted journalism labeled the case as religion versus science.
December 4, 2007, editorial, Evolution in Texas. Is Texas about to become the next state to undermine the teaching of evolution? That is the scary implication of the abrupt ousting of Christine Comer, the state's top expert on science education.
I was just doing my job. I just forwarded an email of an upcoming lecture, and that was the simple fact of it. Then I got a phone call from my immediate supervisor. She said, we're having a meeting tomorrow, and we need you to be there. I said, absolutely. So imagine my surprise when I get there and they give me a memo of termination. When it first happened, I was so embarrassed I didn't want anyone to know. I was going to go quietly into that good night. But I felt like I had to fight. And they said, I have until 8 o'clock the next morning to either sign a letter of resignation or I would be terminated. They actually said that I had to be neutral about the teaching of creationism. I went, what? I said, are you serious? This is over creationism? I thought, how can I remain neutral on something that is non-science? I got emails from people in Paris, in Hawaii, in Alaska, in London, and former students contacted me and they said, Ms. Comer, you know, keep on fighting. Stand up for the kids of Texas. I used to think it was just a radical fringe group, but it seems like now it's part of the political scene here in Texas now to back a group that is anti-science.
This is Dr. Richard von Sternberg, mild-mannered research scientist. Until 2005, he also edited a small scientific journal affiliated with the Smithsonian Institution in Washington until he published an article by this man. As a result, Dr. Sternberg quickly found himself the object of a massive campaign that smeared his reputation and came close to destroying his career.
After the publication of the Meyer article, the climate changed. It moved from being chilly to being outright hostile. Shunned, yes, and discredited. What I'm asking for is the freedom to follow the evidence wherever it leads.
What was so damning about this article? Nothing, as far as I could tell. It merely suggested that perhaps we aren't mud animated by lightning after all. Dr. Meyer argued that there are signs of intelligent design in nature. The digital code in our DNA could not have come about by accident. Instead of a cosmic mistake, he says the evidence seems to indicate that we are the product of a higher intelligence. Publishing Dr. Meyer's paper would not have been an issue if we were living in the time of Galileo or Einstein. But unfortunately for Dr. Sternberg, we live in a very different era. This is the era of Darwin, and in such an era, those who challenge the status quo seldom go unpunished. As I investigated this situation, I discovered Dr. Sternberg is far from alone. Many other scientists face similar persecution. They're losing their jobs, they can't get tenure, they're denied publication in scientific journals, and they're openly ridiculed and ostracized by their peers. All for questioning Darwin.
It's the kind of thing where you just learn to keep your mouth shut. I have been told to shut up.
We were accused of being diabolical, theocratic conspirators who were trying to force religion into the classroom.
It isn't just scientists attacking these guys either. The media's in on it. The courts. The educational system. Everyone's after them. I guess I shouldn't be surprised. After all, these guys are asking some pretty dangerous questions, suggesting that Darwinism is not only improbable, it might actually be dangerous. I should know better than to ask such questions. After all, I've been warned.
But on the whole, they're not scientists. Intelligent design is not a research program.
And it's all propaganda.
They're distracting you from what's important.
As a scientist, I am pretty hostile to a rival doctrine.
The more I thought about the situation, the more I wondered why we tolerate free speech in every other area of the society, but not here. What makes this situation so different? In my experience, People who are confident in their ideas are not afraid of criticism. So that tells me the Darwinists are afraid. They're hiding something.
We're so schizophrenic. We talk about things being designed and optimized. But then when you ask us, especially in public, we're all about defending neo-Darwin.
Here by Robert Gentry. Robert Gentry is a good friend of mine from Tennessee. He is a very famous scientist who did work on the disposal of radioactive waste, nuclear waste. What do you do with this waste product? He would do research on the granites around the world. He discovered that as you look at granites under a microscope, you find they got little tiny halos in them, radiopolonium halos. We'll get into more of that later. But as soon as they found out that his research was proving evolution is not true, because he really proves the Earth was never a hot molten mass. He never mentioned creation, never mentioned God, just purely scientific research. They published him in all the major journals until somebody said, wow, guys, Gentry's work is proving the Big Bang Theory wrong. They took away his funding and shut him off like a spigot. They persecuted somebody just because his work was not supporting the sacred cow, i.e. evolution. Roger DeHart was a science teacher at Burlington Edson High School near Seattle. He was told, they brought him into the office and said, you cannot tell your students about errors in the textbooks. All he was doing was bringing in current science journals. Here's a textbook that says the baby has gill slits, like we covered on video 4. The heart would bring in a science journal, says, guys, I'm sorry, it says in the textbook on page 220 that the baby has gills. That's not true. Here's a current science journal. See, here's the evidence. He never mentioned God, never mentioned the Bible, never mentioned creation. He just said this textbook's not accurate, and they told him he couldn't do that. You can't inform your students that the book is out of date? That's the kind of persecution Christians get when they try to go against this evolution theory. Evolution is a carefully protected state religion. Just like communism was a carefully protected state religion when you grew up over there. You don't dare question it. Okay? Kevin Haley was a biology teacher in Oregon. He lost his job simply because he exposed errors in the textbooks. He told them, hey, this book's not right. There's a mistake here. He said, you're fired. Can't teach if you say there's errors in our books. Baylor University in Waco, Texas, fired William Dembski in April 2000 simply because he told his students there might be an intelligent designer. He said, oh, you're not allowed to say that. So they fired him. This is Baylor. It used to be a Christian college, okay? Horace Mims was a science writer for years. He wrote for many major journals, National Geographic, Science Digest, American Journal of Physics. He wrote for all kinds of articles for magazines. But then when he applied for a job at Scientific American, he was denied. They said, you can't work here because you are a creationist. Even though what he was writing on has nothing whatsoever to do with the subject of creation or evolution, they said, we don't want you on our staff because it would look bad if we hired a creationist. That's the type of persecution you get. Rod Laveque was told, he told his students, I kind of doubt this Darwin theory is true. So they took him away from teaching biology and gave him another job. They said, we don't want you teaching biology because you might make our students doubt Darwin's theory. That's how it's protected. It's a religion. There's a teacher in Indiana, Dan Clark, his principal called him in, Ed Eller, the superintendent, and said he could not introduce creation to his class. Now, there's no law against teaching creation at all. There are no court cases that says you can't teach creation. They just said you can't be mandatory. But teachers always have the right to teach creation. Here's the problem. The law says you can teach it, the court says you can teach it, but your boss now says you can't. So he quit his job finally over that. He stood firm and said, look, I'm not going to bow to this one. He quit his job. Dean Kenyon wrote the book, Pandas and People. He was a science teacher at San Francisco State University. He wrote this book and says, it's a biology textbook, basically, a science textbook, that says, hey, there must have been some kind of designer. This is so complicated. This is amazing. There must have been a designer. It doesn't try to get him saved or converted to be a Baptist or a Buddhist or a Catholic. It just says, look, there must be a designer. He was a tenured biology professor, San Francisco State University. He had written all kinds of books about evolution when he believed in it. Then he got converted and said, I really doubt that theory is true. It doesn't work. And so they fired him. But he was tenured, so he sued them and got his job back, and they put him in as a lab assistant washing test tubes, stuff that, the students do. He had to sue him again to get his real job back. Just because he said, I think there might be a creator to this universe. That's the type of persecution you get. When I spoke in Lubbock, Texas, several years ago, he had a professor there named Dr. Dinney, D-I-N-I, who teaches biology. He told his students, if you don't believe in evolution, don't come ask me
for a recommendation to go off to medical school, because I won't give you one. He said, it was on his website for years. He said, if you don't believe in evolution, you'll never get a recommendation from me. Well, when I went to speak there in Lubbock, Texas, the students offered Dr. Denny $1,000 if he would debate me for 2 hours, and he refused. $1,000 for 2 hours. That's pretty good money, Leah. How'd you like to make $1,000 for 2 hours? I mean, he said, no, he won't do it. It's the persecution that happens against Christians and against creationists in the secular school system is mind-boggling. What are they afraid of? So I say, well, it's not true that all scientists believe in creation, but many scientists that do believe in creation are afraid to say anything because they know the kind of persecution you're going to get. How many teachers were there in Ukraine that did not believe in communism but didn't dare say anything about it? And anybody even does that, if you don't even smile right at Stalin, he'd kill you. You know, you'd end up in the gulag someplace. That's the kind of thing that's happened in America, believe it or not. If a person doesn't support the evolution theory vocally and actively, they'll be banished to academic Siberia. They lose their grant money. They will lose their job. It's sad. And Patrick Henry College was told back in November of 2002, I believe, that they weren't going to get accreditation because they didn't teach enough evolution in their college. There's an article in Agape Press here. A university professor said she was asked to resign for introducing elite students to flaws in Darwinian thought at the Mississippi University for Women. I spoke just north of there a few weeks after this happened. I talked to some of the people involved. This lady was told she had to resign her job because she was her teaching might make students doubt Darwinism. What are they going to school for, an education or indoctrination? Yeah, you're going to get an education, I thought. And it used to be that way, but it's just not anymore. It's pretty sad. And this lady said that this professor that wanted to fire her hadn't even heard her speech. But she was, you know, raising doubts about Darwinism. All kinds of scientists down through history, I mean like thousands of them, all the branches of science were started by creationists. There's a list, there's a good list on Answers in Genesis. Just go to answersingenesis.org website and type in scientists who believe creation. And it'll bring up all kinds of articles and you can read about all these scientists down through history who have been creationists. Very famous scientists. I've often asked evolutionists, I say, guys, can you name me one advancement in modern science we've had because of the evolution theory? Is that why we have computers? Is that why we have, you know, telephones, radios? Is that why we went to the moon? What advancements can be named because of this evolution theory? They've never given an answer. There is nothing. The theory is useless. But all major science, all the whole branches of science in the last 400 years were started by creationists. Now, they weren't all young earth creationists like me, and they certainly weren't all independent, temperamental, fundamental, right-wing, radical Baptists like me. But they were, you know, creationists. Wernher von Braun, the head of our space program, was a creationist. A.E. Wildersmith, William Ramsey, the Wright brothers. They studied birds. They said, we want to see how the designer, the creator, how God made the birds, and we'll learn how to make an airplane by studying airplanes. The guy who invented the MRI, magnetic resonance imaging machine, is a young earth creationist. They're a creationist today. There are a couple of good books we have in our library or for sale on our website. In 6 days is one, and on the seventh day. This is 50 scientists who believe in creation. Here's 40 more scientists who believe in creation. You can get these. There are thousands of scientists who do believe in creation, do not believe in evolution. Karl Popper, a famous leading philosopher of science, he said, evolution is not a fact. Evolution doesn't even qualify as a theory or hypothesis. It's a metaphysical research program. It's not really testable science. Evolution is a religion. And they get so angry when I tell them that. Which is probably why I tell them that, you know, every few minutes, because I enjoy pushing the right buttons, you know. Julian Huxley, his grandfather, Thomas Huxley, was the guy who really pushed Darwin when Darwin's book came out. Julian Huxley said, I suppose the reason we left at Origin of Species was the idea of God interfered with our sexual mores. We don't want God telling us what to do. That's why they've accepted evolution. Michael Ruse said, evolution is promoted by its practitioners as more than a mere science. Evolution is promulgated as an ideology of secular religion, a full-fledged alternative to Christianity with meaning and morality. He said, I am an ardent evolutionist and an ex-Christian, but I must admit that in this one complaint, and Mr. Gish is one of many to make it, the literalists are right. Evolution is a religion. This was true of evolution in the beginning, and it's true of evolution still today. Evolution is a religion in every sense of the word. Evolution is a fairy tale for grown-ups. The theory has helped nothing in the progress of science. It's useless. So it's not true they all believe it. Nearly all branches of science were started by creationists. Evolution theories added nothing to science. When students or professors fear expressing their real honest thoughts, they're not getting educated, they're getting indoctrinated. Students get flunked for not supporting the evolution theory. Every week when I go out and speak, somebody will come to me and say, when I was in biology class, I wrote a paper and the teacher gave me an F because it didn't support evolution. Or because I dared to go against the evolution theory. I get calls like that. Diane, you take some of the calls and transfer them over to me. Students saying, hey, what do I do? My teacher gave me an F because I didn't. My paper went against evolution. It's sad. I mean, it's discrimination.
So that people who believe in creationism are being persecuted in America?
Oh, without, there's no doubt about it. We have lots and lots of evidence of it in the movie. And, you know, Einstein worked within the framework of believing there was a God. Newton worked within the framework of believing there was a God. For gosh sakes, Darwin worked within the framework of believing there was a God. And yet, somehow today, you're not allowed to believe it. Why can't we have as much freedom as Darwin?
I don't know. It's an excellent question. I've never been able to understand why the secular authorities in education, all right, basically persecute people who raise a very legitimate question. Hey, you guys haven't figured it out, you secular pinheads. You haven't figured it out. You had a lot of time. So perhaps we just want to let the kids know there are two opinions on this. But no, you can't have the kids hear that. Separation of church and state. I'll give you the last word, Mr. Smith.
Because there's so much fear out there in the secular community that their position is so precarious. We're not trying to shut them down. We just want to be allowed to talk and think.
Just want to have all cards put on the academic table.
Exactly.
All right, Ben Steiner.
If, and I appreciate the fact that you have a problem with this, but if people see religion as the source of their morality, and let's assume for a second that it's the good part, the stuff we can all agree on, don't kill, don't envy, honor parents, and so on, where do atheists find their moral code from?
I have denied to you that religious people get their morals from religion. Religious people get their morals from the same place atheists get. Quite difficult answering where we all get our morals from, but whatever else it is, it isn't religion. If you ask, where do we get our condemnation of slavery from? Well, that's certainly not from religion. It's from somewhere else. Now, if you press me to say, where do we all... I'm not going to answer, where do atheists get it from? I'm going to answer, where do we all get it from?
But can't you humor me for that?
No.
Why not?
Because it's the wrong way to put the question. We all get our morals from somewhere else. I'm now going to try to answer where that is.
Where is it?
I think it's from a steadily shifting consensus of moral philosophy, of legal judgments, of parliamentary votes, of journalistic editorials, of dinner party conversations. There's a whole zeitgeist which is steadily moving, and you can tell that it's moving because the moral outlook of today is actually quite different from what it was 100 years ago, and even more different from 200 years ago. There's a steadily shifting moral zeitgeist which is fed by this complicated interplay of all the things that I just mentioned, judicial decisions and so on.
Aldous Huxley, author of Brave New World and brother of Julian Huxley, gave a speech at Berkeley in 1962, shortly before his death. He admitted that his best-selling book, Brave New World, written in 1932, was based not on fiction, but on what the elite were actually planning to implement.
And here I would like briefly to compare the parable of Brave New World with another parable which was put forth more recently in George Orwell's book 1984. I'm inclined to think that the scientific dictatorships of the future, and I think there are going to be scientific dictatorships in many parts of the world, will be probably a good deal nearer to the Brave New World pattern than to the 1984 pattern. They will be a good deal nearer, not because of any humanitarian qualms in the scientific dictators, but simply because the Brave New World pattern is probably a good deal more efficient than the other. But if you can get people to consent to the state of affairs in which they are living, the state of servitude, the state of being, well, it seems to me that the nature of the ultimate revolution with which we are now faced is precisely this, that we are in process of developing a whole series of techniques which will enable the controlling oligarchy, who have always existed and presumably always will exist, to get people actually to love their servitude. People can be made to enjoy a state of affairs which, by any decent standard, they ought not to enjoy. And these methods, I think, are a real refinement on the older methods of terror, because they combine methods of terror with methods of acceptance. But then there are the various other methods which one can think of. There is, for example, the pharmacological method. This was one of the things I talked about in Brave New World. And the result would be that, you can imagine a euphoric which would make people thoroughly happy even in the most abominable circumstances. These things are possible.